Welcome to Discover Indie Film. I am your host, Jeff Howard, and today's interview is going to be with David Weiss, who has, I'll be honest, a special spot in my heart. David had a feature film in the first film festival that I was ever the head programmer of. That was Film Invasion Los Angeles in 2016. And then 2 years later, actually like 2.5 years later, he came back with an amazing short film called Cap, which won all kinds of awards. And honestly, it's beautiful work. Both films are great. And so it had always been a goal of mine to get David on the podcast. And get this, he and I spoke, I believe, via Skype. Might have been FaceTime or Skype, on July 29th of 2019. So this is actually being released nearly a full 2 years later. So I'm not going to give you all my excuses for why it sat in the archives for so long, but I am delighted to finally be releasing it. My apologies to David for the long, silly, long-ass wait, but the wait is over, and now you get to hear all about David Weiss and his really interesting career. Such a motivated, artistic guy, successful in business and art, which is rare as heck. So anyway, after this, I will mention the Discover Indie Film TV series on Amazon Prime and the two film festivals and this and that. But right now, let's jump right into it with David.
You know, I do it because I have to do it, not because I believe that that's the possibility of the future. I think you always have this fantasy in your back of your mind, like, oh, that might be something that could happen someday. But at the end of the day, I still have to make movies. I have some form of addiction to it. You know, I just love it. So,
which is fantastic. Those are the best filmmakers, is the ones who are like, you know, if I could stop, I would, but I have to do this.
Right. Yeah.
So how'd you get to that point? Were you a film kid?
I grew up watching TV, mainly, and, you know, of course there's movies on TV and stuff like that too. And so my parents were really, I was the last kid, and they were kind of done raising kids. And so they kind of let me do whatever I wanted to. And so I literally slept on the couch and watched TV all the time growing up, and which, you know, was not good for my health as a young kid. But you know, I learned a lot in that process, but I never thought of myself as ever being, you know, like growing up, I was thinking like, oh, I want to be a filmmaker someday. And honestly, my parents were all about the professions. My dad and mom both taught biology at college level and first high school. And then they went on and taught at college. And so they were always about the professions. And so they're like, you're going to be a lawyer or a doctor. And so I did mock trial and debate and all that stuff. And I was going to be a lawyer. I went to the University of Iowa first. And, you know, I got there and I had gotten a C in some class, I think French in high school. And my mom said, either find a class that you're getting a B or an A in, or, you know, you're not doing anything for a long time. And so I went and took an art class. And then I felt like I was really great at it, and I excelled in art and won a bunch of awards and
like that kind of painting, or
yeah, like every kind of art, like from graphic design to, you know, to painting, right, to
sculpture,
to drawing. Yeah, I didn't do sculpture. That would be the one thing I didn't get into.
Right.
Yep.
But drawing and painting, so a lot of visual arts.
Yeah, totally the visual arts. And so, but my parents were always like, oh, that's great. It's cool. You got a hobby. But you're going to be, you know, you're going to be a lawyer. If you, you know, you're going to have a profession. You're not going to, like, as teachers, I think they felt like, you know, you work so hard and, they just didn't feel like they were compensated for what they did. And I think that's true in a lot of things, especially in high school teachers. There's so many teachers that, you know, they do so much for so many people and just don't get paid very well. So I went to University of Iowa and I had a great teacher there. Margaret Duffy was her name, and I'll forget it. She said to me, I said, I want to be an artist. And she said, well, then be an artist. And I said, you're right. I'm going to be an artist. So I called my dad and I said, Dad, I'm going to drop out. I'm going to go and study art at a different school. And he said, that's great, Dave, you're on your own. And so that's kind of what I was. I was on my own. And
very old school parenting. That was,
yeah. 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 I think they were just like, they loved me, but they were like, you got to, if that's what you want to do, then you're on your own. You got to take your own risks then, and you'll find your way. And honestly, it was probably the best thing that ever happened, because I went and studied graphic design first. And then I started a sign company on the side, went to the University of Nebraska at Lincoln and studied advertising. And then there's, you know, I started a couple other little businesses. That's a long story. One of them being a bungee jumping company, but, that's a whole nother story out in Long Island and everything, but came back to, Lincoln, studied advertising, and then started a sign company. And that kind of blew up for me. And so I ran with it and had that for quite a few years, and then trained as an oil painter. I would go and take workshops, 'cause I was like, I want to be a classically trained painter. And so I would work 2 weeks, and then I would take off 2 weeks and go to these workshops. And then I met a lady by named Christine Berner, who was a accomplished oil painter, master oil painter down in Oklahoma. And I would go down there and stay for 2 weeks at a time and learn to paint. And so then I started getting gallery representation, and that kind of started to grow. I kept my sign company going and on the side, and then, did murals, things like that. And then, the oil painting started to take off. I had about 5 or 6 galleries, and I had a really big show in 08 in Southwest Art, had a full page ad and all this other stuff. And I thought, well, this is going to be it. You know, this is like, you know, this is the deal. And so it was at the Adam Whitney Gallery, I had all my paintings, and I was in the basement. This is like, they had like a two-tier, they had a basement level, and that's where all the paintings were hung. And then people were flying in. I had a couple people flying in from out of town to see the paintings. And I remember being in the basement, and it was, you know, I'll use that in a movie someday. But I remember being in the basement alone with my paintings, because the sales reps were upstairs and the show hadn't kicked off yet. And the stock market had just started to crash. It was 07, 08 right in there. I can't remember the exact date, but the market had just started to crash. Lehman Brothers had not gone away yet. And so it wasn't like the complete crash, right? It was just like the beginning of the crash.
Right, and people felt it coming.
Yes, yes. And I was there by myself with my paintings, and I thought, this is all over. I don't know what it was. It wasn't audible, but it was like in my head, like this, you're alone with your paintings. This is over. This is, you're going to have to start a new career. And within 6 months, that gallery closed, and most of the galleries that represented me closed.
Because you could feel that like disposable income for the fine arts was going away.
Yeah. And I was in that $4,000 to $6,000 range. I know there's a lot of stuff that people just don't know, but you learn it when you get into any industry. But like, I was in that $4,000 to $6,000 range of paintings.
Yeah, and the guy, very well established.
Yeah, it's pretty good. But like, if you're under $12,000 at that time, might be even more now. But if you were under $12,000 at that time, you were done, because you weren't an investment. You were a painting people loved. If you were above $12,000, people still perceived you as a possible investment. And so the wealthy invested in the paintings that already had bigger values.
The 1% who weren't going to be affected by the downturn.
Yes, yes.
But you were in the range of people actually liked your work.
Yes, yes, yes.
Talk about a slap of reality about art and culture. If people purchase your work because they like it, it's not as good as if they purchase it because they think they can make money off it.
Agreed.
God damn.
Agreed, man. Yeah, it's a different world, right? Like, and I was a representational artist. I wasn't an abstract artist. My work was pretty real, but I got into what they call tonalism. And so I was kind of moving in that direction, and that stuff was really doing well, but I just had not taken that next leap. And I always thought to myself, like, you know, I couldn't believe it. I was like, I can't believe this is happening. 'Cause you know, I've had a couple ups and downs. Anytime you're self-employed, you're going to have your ups and downs. That's the reality of the business, being in business by yourself. And so, So I went back to school at night. I just started taking classes, and I was going to do some type of programming I had to figure out something quickly just to generate enough capital to survive. And so I took a class called Moving Image Lab, which was basically video production. And that was it. I was like, I had always dreamed about it when I was in advertising. I'd always fantasized about like owning a production company and that, but it wasn't very realistic back then, because what happens is you couldn't afford the entry point was so high. But you know, when Canon came out with the, you know, 5D Mark II, that entry point changed. And so you could make a film now that looked pretty close to, you know, a theatrical film, and you could afford to do it. And so then that's when, for me, it was like, well, this is it. And so I went and I studied animation, and then I also studied cinema, and then I got my degree in animation, but I have a certificate in cinema too. And so I started a production company. And so I had done some work with, worked with a couple guys here in town, and they worked with ad agencies. And so I started doing a little bit of work there, but I had a buddy, I did a promo piece for him, and he was a voice guy for the Kansas City Chiefs. And the Chiefs loved the piece, and they asked me to come down and shoot something for them. And so I went down to Kansas City and shot a piece for them. And then that opened up a door to shoot a reality series called Backstage Confidential that I developed with Bill Reed out of Virginia. And that was why about the music industry and behind the scenes, basically, of the music industry.
Right. So you were being very practical with your early video production.
It was totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just like your sign business. So it was more like your sign business than your art pursuit.
Yes. Agreed. Yeah. And that's where, you know, and that I was just looking to develop content and learn how the process worked without actually having to go to a full film school too. And along the way. And so I started getting into documentaries at first. And that seemed to do really well. I went to Haiti once and did a documentary there first, and then I came back. And, so I did a documentary called Shakespeare Noodles. And then that was about a Shakespeare fest that the lady created, that all you do is all the kids were dressed in noodles. You know, of course they had outfits on, but then they dressed them in the pool noodles. I don't know if you ever seen those. And so it was all this.
I know what a pool noodle is. I'm trying to figure out what it looks like. There's like wrapping a kid in noodle.
Yeah. But she designed it, cut them and created all these different looks out of them. It was pretty amazing. And, it was a great way for kids to learn Shakespeare. And so I did a documentary on that. And then I wanted to start getting into narrative. And so I did a film called Leaving Kansas. Chuck Mattan had written it, and I did it, co-directed it with him.
Right. But you made the decision to do a narrative, and then you started looking for scripts, or was it a thing where you saw, someone you knew gave you this script and you said, wow, I want to make that.
Yeah. That's what basically it came down to. And I knew I kind of wanted to move into narrative, and Chuck was like, cause Chuck had encouraged me to do Shakespeare with Noodles. And so, I knew about it. And so then he's like, hey, Dave, would you be interested in doing this film? And I read it and I'm like, yeah, I want to move into narrative. And then from there, I just started working on other projects with other people's films too. And just trying to learn the actual, cause you know, video production for corporate world is different than, unless it's commercials, of course, than narrative filmmaking. So you have to kind of, it's a little bit different approaches, bigger crews on a film, you know, things like that you have to kind of work with, but you know, you can one man band it almost, you know, usually you have a sound guy with you, but on corporate type commercial work. And so then that kind of developed, I got some awards for the films I had done up till that point. And then I wanted to take on a feature cause I wanted to see what it was like to really make a feature film. And so, Jason Levering had approached me with this concept. And I just said, if you rewrite the script was written by Garrett Cheeks. I said, if Jason rewrites it and we can all work together, then I'll develop it with you. And so we did. But that took us about a year to make Black Luck. And, which we've done, you know, Black Luck for what the film is, and you know, it is what it is, right? I mean, we shot it on weekends and, looking back at it now, it's hard for me to watch, but at the time,
a lot of people have a hard time watching their first feature, but I'll vouch for you and say that for an independent feature that's hitting the festival circuit. And I believe now it's on Prime and iTunes and stuff. Right.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
I mean, you guys took on making an action revenge flick.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
You know, you didn't shoot four people sitting in a living room sipping coffee.
Right. No, we had multiple locations. We had, you know, old custom cars and, you know, we had a lot of stuff that we had to incorporate.
Yeah. I mean, it was big and ambitious and I would argue you pulled it off. I can get that it's very rare for me to talk to a director who looks at that early stuff and doesn't say, okay, well, there's like 2 minutes out of the 90 I wouldn't change.
Right. Yeah.
But it was a success, man. It really was. Man.
Yeah.
The film works.
I think we've done close to 200,000 hours on Amazon. So,
nice.
That's a lot of viewing, you know, for a independent feature film that was made for maybe, I don't know, we were under 20. I mean, everybody was just bootstrapping.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's over 100,000 views, 100,000 uniques. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a pretty good opening weekend.
yeah, exactly.
If you think about it.
And you know, and then for the fact that it's an hour and 20 minutes long, for people to view that many hours it was pretty amazing. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, so we felt like it's gone well. We're trying to gear up to do some more films, but,
And also it was really just your foray of like, that was your first dip in the narrative pool.
Yeah. Really, truly narrative. Yep. Agreed. And then the following year I came back, and then, or it was a year after that, I had a bunch of commercial work. I've been blessed that I've been really, really busy with that. So that goes well, but I'm trying to keep going back to making projects. And so I made a film called Cap, and that's what screened at Sherman Oaks. And that was about Haiti and traveling down to Haiti. And it was that's a narrative.
Right. I didn't mention for people listening that, yeah, Black Luck, the feature, played at the first Film Invasion Los Angeles ever.
Yes, yes.
And that you guys kicked ass, and it was really fun to have you there.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, and now you're bringing up Cap, which is a beautiful film that could not be more opposite from Black Luck.
Yeah, oh, totally. Yeah, Cap was kind of like, I had gone down and shot some, these guys go down and do volunteer work in Haiti, and they had set up orphanages down there and donated their time to a couple farmers out of northern Iowa, and amazing people. And my brother was connected because he's a surgeon, and he was donating. He keeps a surgeon on staff for them, a doctor on staff for them. He pays for it. And so he wanted me to come down with him the first time when I went down. Well, they asked me to come back and do it again the second time to go down. And it's all volunteer work. I'm not, you know, how can you charge somebody
while you're
there? You're
also helping. You're helping out while you're there too, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I'm shooting video that I cut together to help them raise funds, you know? And so that's the purpose of it. That's why I do it, so that they can keep doing what they do. So I went down, but the second time they asked me to go down, I said, I have no problem. I'll do all this stuff for free again and go down. But the only thing is, I want 2 days to shoot whatever I want to shoot. So I said, I just want to have 2 days to shoot whatever I want. And I had this idea for kids, when I was down there last time, these kids flying kites, and you know, they make them out of anything. And I just thought it'd be cool if I could make a movie about what's called Restavik, and it's child slavery, which I didn't know existed. And I got down there and I was like, these kids that end up in the orphanage a lot of times have been abused, and they have been in what they call Restavik, and it means to live with in Creole. And so, but basically they become, it's a form of like a house slave, and these kids are living in somebody else's home. They're given up. They don't go to school. They don't eat with the families usually. And it's really a kind of a terrible situation for a lot of children.
And it's Haitian children becoming indentured servants / slaves in another household so that they get a little bit of food.
Right. Agreed. Because, you know, the family, you know, the poverty is so bad there that some women can't afford to live. The husbands leave them. And, you know, so it's just this terrible cycle that's occurred, and nobody seems to want to talk about it. And so for me, it was me, you know, like for my purposes, like, I just wanted to expose what it was, and like, so that people knew that it was going on. And so that if somehow enough people know about it, then people maybe will step in and try to do the right thing and help somehow, you know. And there's some organizations now that are doing more of that. And even the orphanage they take in kids, but just to raise awareness that, you know, it's outlawed now finally, but the government doesn't have any money to do anything about it. And so
it's a law without enforcement.
Right. Agreed. And so then I decided, I wanted to do this story, tell a story about that somehow. So I just incorporated the kid with the kite and him, you know, him making a kite. He's basically a Restavik for this family. And, but he, along the way, he takes this little girl to school, and he makes a kite to fly away. And because that's all he really wants to do, is he wants to have a second chance at life. And so that's kind of the storyline. And it exposes the reality of what that world is.
Yeah. And did that all come to you in between visits, or was it after you got down there and you were looking around?
Yeah. After the first time I went down there, I came back and I'm like, I was thinking about it. And I went to my buddy, Jason Levering, again, and he originally wrote Black Luck, and I had written out my ideas on it. And I said, let's develop this more into a tighter little script. I'll take it down and I'll just shoot it. And so he helped develop it with me, and we got it really tight. I knew it could only be like 8 pages. And so I got down there and they gave me the 2 days, and I had, fortunately, one of the lead actors could somewhat interpret. And so we had a few locations right around. There was a school there, and I had cast a couple kids as actually a brother and sister, and they were amazing, amazing children.
Yeah, wonderful. And super
smart. They picked up everything so quickly. The only thing was, they got kind of tired because they just weren't used to it, you know. But it wasn't like we were running long days. But I shot everything basically in almost a day and a half, And we only had so many hours a day with the kids. And so it was really kind of a quick shoot, but it taught me a lot from the standpoint of like a story you can tell quickly and express it in a way. But what happened is I got home and I watched it, and after I cut it, I watched it, I don't know if I really, because the mother gives the child away. Well, you don't really know who this woman is with the child giving this child away. It could be like, that could be her ex-husband. She's just bringing, her ex-boyfriend. She's just bringing her son to him. You just have no idea. So I had to go with a voiceover. So then I wrote a voiceover script based on what I knew from down there. And then I had met this actress by the name of Candace Jean Jocks, who's a fantastic actress. I can't recommend her highly enough. I'd taken a workshop with Adrian Weiss in New York City on directing, and I had met Candace there, and she helped with this. I had written the script. She came back and wrote it Haitian and Creole. And then she found a voiceover, a young voiceover actor who could play the part for me. And then
you didn't have the boy who's on camera
right.
Read those lines. You went, no. You recorded it high quality back here.
Yep. Agreed. Yep. And so that's kind of how I played it. And then, you don't, unless you tell people, then they never know. And that's the art of storytelling, correct? It's like,
that's the medium. That's understanding the medium and knowing how to get the best out of it.
Yeah. And so, we finished it up, and that film out of all the stuff I've done probably is one of my greatest works. And I felt like it was it had an expression towards humanity, and I love that part of it. I think my purpose, I think sometimes in life is like, I've written out a statement of like what I want to do. And I want to do work that inspires people and humanity. Right. And so, and I love doing Black Luck, but that's that normal thriller kind of like, just action film for a low budget, of course, but Cap for me was more of an emotional film. And I think it gets at the heartstrings, but also raises awareness in the process. And so that's really, for me, that's where I really enjoyed it. So,
I don't see how, you wouldn't just be filled with joyous satisfaction with Cap.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, not an egotistical way, but to make something, and I'll chime in that it looks beautiful. The quality of it is just superb.
Oh,
the performances
so
are superb. Everything about it is superb. So superb that, of course, as we joked about at the Q&A at Sherman Oaks Film Festival, half the audience is thinking this is documentary while they're watching it because it's so real. And you have to say to yourself, well, but if it's a documentary, it wouldn't look so good.
Right. Agreed. Yeah.
And,
agreed from the standpoint of I had the documentary aspect.
Yeah.
I shot at Cinema Verite, and so it's very handheld through the whole thing.
Yeah.
And it had that look to it. But I actually was nominated and won an award for documentary, and it wasn't a documentary, it was all narrative. So.
How funny. And now that, it's funny, I don't know if I remember you telling us at the Q&A that the two kid actors were brother and sister.
Yeah.
But even those performances, you managed to, she is so mean to him.
Yes.
And it's, I think one of the most powerful things is that it's showing us that, cruelty doesn't have to be racial.
No.
And slavery, it completely removes race from slavery and cruelty.
Agreed.
And, this girl is so, she considers him so subhuman.
Yeah.
Which I guess most sisters do think that of their brothers. So
Exactly. So maybe it was easier than we thought for her.
Smart casting, yeah.
Right. Well, they were just so smart. I mean, I talked to them a little bit, and they were, I could just tell, these kids are brilliant. I mean, they were, brilliant. And I was, and the fact that he could pull off what he pulled off, never really have acted.
Yeah, the emotions that he's conveying are, I know, that's pretty wonderful.
Yeah.
And it sounds like it was just a rewarding process the whole way through for you.
Yeah, it was good. I think at the time, the people I was with didn't understand what I was doing. So they didn't, for them, they're down there to help these kids. And they just think in a lot of ways, they probably think I'm just wasting time. And so for them, they're like, they just didn't get it. And so that was I kind of ran into a little bit of roadblocks with them too. Cause they're like, why do you need to be doing this? Why couldn't you be doing something? You know? And so I was like, I know you don't think it's possible that anything's going to come out of this because I've only had it for a few hours. And I know that this seems really odd. It's not going to work, but you got to trust me that this thing could be, you know, it could be a really powerful piece that tells the story that it may not help you guys directly, meaning like the orphanage itself, but it'll definitely raise awareness for Haiti if it gets enough run, you know, enough people see it.
Yeah. So. Well, cause you have with your background doing a production company, doing corporate videos and advertising.
Yeah.
You've seen the power.
Oh man. Yeah.
That images can convey messages.
Yes. Agreed. 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 And once they saw it after I had done it, they were like, okay, we apologize. You know, they're like, we just had no idea, you know, that it was going to be anything.
I say this to a couple people per year, but I imagine you probably had a really good festival run with it.
Yeah, I did. I mean, you know, I did Holly Shorts. I was in quite a few Action On and,
Were any of them Oscar qualifying?
I did qualify it. I didn't win. I won some awards at Action On, but at Hollywood Dreams, but I did not win at Holly Shorts. And that would be been the one. I was in Montreal Black Film Festival as well. And then I think there were a couple other ones too.
I guarantee this is the thing that I say to a couple people here. I guarantee that the shorts I see nominated for an Oscar, there's going to be a handful that are not as good. And your film definitely.
Oh, thank you so much.
You know what I mean? If it were nominated and it's going to be, honestly, I don't understand how nominations for shorts works because often there's some great, there's always out of the five, there's like two great ones and then three that you're just scratching your head.
Right.
And just the message that could get out there if it was nominated, my God.
Yeah, no, agreed. That's where you hoped for. But yeah, I did not, it qualified through, I went and did a short run in LA and it qualified, but it didn't make the short list.
Right. So. Oh, so it would have, that was the year before? That was last year. Right, yep, right. So it would have been this January if it had happened.
Yeah.
Well, fuck the Academy. What can I say? I'll curse.
That's all good.
I'm the one who gets mad at the choices.
Right. I think that the year before, what was the name of the film? They were in my block with Holly Shorts at Holly Shorts, and then they ended up winning the Academy Award, and that was the blind girl.
The year Silence, before.
Not Silence, was it? What was the name of that? Yeah. I'm trying to remember the name. I can't remember it often. Something Child.
Yeah. Oh, I'm forgetting. I saw it. It was pretty good.
Yeah, it was a beautiful film.
I thought of the five nominees, there was another one I liked even better. There was an amazing one shot in Africa.
Okay.
Amazing film, but what are you going
to do? Yeah. No, I mean, you know, it's all subjective. That's where I never get.
Especially, right. I mean, whatever. There's 10,000 shorts made a year, so.
Yeah, gosh. Just the fact that I got into festivals and that, you know, people saw the film, I was ecstatic over, to be honest. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
I never take this for granted.
And now you're working with a nonprofit, you said?
Yeah, so I do a lot of, you know, my biggest clients are nonprofit clients. So like Boys Town is a town, I don't know if you ever heard of Boys Town?
Famous, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it is.
Associated with the famous Boys Town? Or?
It is the famous Boys Town, but the problem, a lot of the younger generation don't know because the Boys Town film that had Mickey Rooney in it, you know, that famous film won an Oscar and really told the story of Boys Town. Well, you know, that movie's been so gone. A lot of people don't even know that there's a town in the middle of Omaha, Nebraska, that it is literally a town. It's Boys Town, Nebraska. And what they do is they take in troubled youth and change their lives. They have people that have in-family home services. And so they have these homes set up where, like, you and your wife would come in. You would live there and these kids would come in and live with you in these homes and you could have your children there too. And you help them learn how to have a normal life and have a normal family life.
So. Right. So it really, I'm going to double up on the word foster, but it fosters a community.
Yes.
To make foster parenting more feasible.
Right. Yeah. And it's, in a way, they kind of become parents to all these kids, but you know, these kids can come and go too. They can be there for a year and go, they have a high school there and they have, you know, all these things set up. They have their own police force and everything. It's actually a town, but it's designed, it was built by Father Flanagan. It was built, oh gosh, what was it? It was 100. We just did the 100-year anniversary. So it would have been 1919 it was founded. There was a famous, it's a very successful Jewish lawyer here in town who kept seeing these kids come through, the justice system and were, you know, basically working in these workhouses. And Father Flanagan wanted to start his own home to help these kids and turn their lives around. Cause he couldn't fix them after they got, you know, he always looked at it as like, it's easy to fix a child. It's hard to fix a man. And so he, you know, to turn their lives around and help them. And so, this Jewish lawyer helped fund the first home for Father Flanagan. And that's what grew into Boys Town over the years. And, you know, the amount of lives that have been changed because of Boys Town is beyond what anybody could ever imagine.
Yeah. So. I guess the real upsetting thing is it hasn't been repeated around the country.
Yeah, I know. Right. Well, they had, you know, services, Boys Town had for services, in California and different parts of the country, but they would always run into legal issues. So, you know, that's where so they've had to pull back some of the in-home family service restrictions. Yeah, I think that's really what happened.
Tough. And my brain always goes to history. I think in 1919, that was World War I era. So there was the number of families losing fathers was really high.
Yeah. Yeah. You had these kids and he was kind of a, you know, he was very wise. He would take the kids on these train rides and they would travel to all these towns and they had like a band and they would perform and then they would raise funds that way. And so he was really smart about getting publicity and helping turn these kids' lives. And he always, Father Flanagan said, there is no bad boy. And he was willing to take boys, you know, a couple of boys that had actually, you know, murdered their family. And he was willing to take them in. He was that, he had this kind of mindset. And he now, and I think it was in the early 60s, they took in girls too. And so it is a boys and girls town, but it's still called Boys Town.
Yeah. So,
yep.
And you're working with them.
Yeah. I work with them directly through, worked with an ad agency for a while with them, Envoy. And then I work directly with Boys Town now too. And what we do is we just tell the stories. And so I get to see these lives change, the process of these kids' lives change. So you come in and, you know, it's a simple story arc. I came in and my life was bad and now I'm leaving and my life is better. And you do see it. I mean, there was one kid, you know, I had a kid that was living on the subway in New York City his mom didn't want him, but he'd go to school every day. So after he was done with school and football, he would go ride the subway. He'd walk around, then get on the subway and ride it back and forth all the way down and back every single night. And that's where he was
sleep. Actually, yeah, something about the New York subway is that it's actually very safe.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yep. It's well policed.
Yeah. And so that's what he would do. And so, and then his coach convinced him to go to Boys Town, his football coach, and he had a connection to Boys Town and convinced him to go there. And Boys Town took him in. And now, you know, he went and got his college degree now. And he teaches physical science and he's doing extremely well. But that's just one example of like hundreds that we experience all the time.
Are you going to put all this together into a feature doc someday?
You know, we talked about it, but, you know, there's some company that came in now and is doing a documentary on it. It's, you know, it's hard for me because I'm more to the client side and Boys Town has to kind of decide that stuff. That's not my,
right.
You know, yeah.
Right. I'm hired to tell a story.
Yeah. I would love to do a feature film. I mean, that's my dream would be to do like at some point would be to do another Boys Town movie because I have a script idea for it and I've been kind of working on it. And it's a different take on it, but I think it's very unique. And I think it would be great. I think they need another one because they do help so many children. And there's only so much, you know, the problem you run into is that it takes a lot of funding to run those homes and to have people in those homes. And you can only, you know, you're only going to generate so much, as a nonprofit, you're only going to generate so much money and you need to raise awareness about what you do. And people just don't know about it. You know, after the Boys Town movie did did so much for them. They had no idea. It was like, you know, created this amazing thing that just, you know, helped them fund for 20 or 30 years, at least. I know it did. But now they don't have that anymore. And so they're trying to figure out ways to let people know that this still exists and they are helping change lives. So,
yeah, truthfully, I think there's so many misconceptions about it because the film is so old.
Yes.
And, yes. I'm sure a lot of people mistakenly think it was a fictional film.
Yeah.
It just, I don't even want to think about how unhelpful the film is now, but I'm old enough. I've heard of it.
Yeah, exactly. Agreed. Yeah. So a modern take on it would be amazing, but they keep kicking it around. I don't know if that'll ever happen or not.
And you're kicking around too.
Yeah. You know, I'd have to do it all completely on my own. I don't, you know, it's one of those things you kind of have to take on by yourself, and so I just don't know yet. But, you know, if it's meant to be, it'll happen. So.
And you going to do any more? You still going back to Haiti?
I'm probably going to go back again. I don't know when. It's been kind of last few months, my dad's been very ill. And so I was dealing with that for quite a while. And so I have, you know, my whole schedule for the year's kind of been put back. We were supposed to shoot a movie this in September, you know, gearing up for another feature. And then things got pushed back because of me. And then the other Jason was working on a play, and so it just kind of got pushed back. But we're hoping that that'll come together.
Oh, so you have another feature lined up?
Yeah. There was two back to back. One's called Open Bar, and the other one is called Justice. And so those are the two main ones kind of lined that are in line to be made. And so we're just trying to put the pieces together. It was still going to be a low budget, but I just don't want to do micro budget again. I want to try to at least have some funding this time around. So.
Right. But, and subject matter, you're doing a little more, having a little more fun with it.
Yeah. So like the Justice is kind of a Black Widow story. And Open Bar is, I don't want to say too much about Open Bar because it's kind of a, yeah.
I'll cross my fingers for you and I'll assume it's pretty original. And I got to say, I often joke with the jury about, you know, sometimes we should just all rate the titles of films and then watch them and rate them and then go back and compare the two numbers because I think titles really matter a lot. And Open Bar, boom, Open Bar. I think I already want to see it.
Yeah, exactly. It's imagine The Hangover meets Goodfellas.
So, right. There you go.
So, yeah.
So that's two relatively successful films.
Right. It's a different approach. Yeah. So that'll be a fun movie. You know, that, I mean, from beginning to end, it's a one long wild ride. So, cool.
Well, I'm glad to hear you're the type who's sticking to it and is not going to let up.
Oh no. No, I've been doing music videos lately. I just got done shooting one for Sony BMG's artist Jocelyn, which is really cool. And hopefully get that released here in the next couple of weeks. So I've been doing more of that, and I love, you can be really creative with music videos, which is great, right?
Yeah, I was going to say, do you get to incorporate your painting background at all?
Oh yeah,
along the line?
For me, you know, I think that's what helped me so much was that I understood composition so well, right? So, you know, I used to play in air paint, what they would call it, which means open air in French. I used to play in air paint a lot. I would go out and paint in the field, what you see directly onto the canvas. And that really, I think that helped lay a base foundation for me of color, but also of composition. And I think what great filmmaking really is storytelling through the visual. I mean, yes, the words matter, but at the end of the day, if the visual... Okay, we'll take this back. I'll take that back. You can have a great visual movie, and if the dialogue's so terrible, nobody will care. But if you have a great visual movie and the dialogue's good, then you have a really outstanding film.
You need both the content and the form.
Yeah. But I focus so much on the visual because I get my energy out of that, right? I love it. I love to see something... interesting. We did a unique take on the music video we shot projected onto a screen in reverse. This part of Jocelyn's life growing up and playing music. And so, but you see her face through the screen. So it was a really unique take. And in that moment, I'm like, yeah, this is why I do this. This is something different. And so, I'm looking for gold in a way. I'm looking for these moments that can, you know, kind of spur the imagination and people enjoy it. So hopefully.
Yeah, no, music video. It's funny. One of my, I've, I think because I'm an American in his 50s, I grew up on, you know, the music video MTV revolution.
Yeah.
And that's partially why we have a music video category at the festivals. And I just, you know, music video, I wish it was more well respected as a type of filmmaking, because some of the best filmmakers came through it. And music video is great. I love music videos.
Yeah, it's fun. It's fun. And there's a lot of films, even like if you look at Black Luck, in a lot of ways, it's like a long music video on some levels, because we use so much music in that film when we cut it together. There was, you know, the Brad Hochschild cut together, and Alexander Hamilton was the guys who designed some of the music design, but he also like wrote some stuff for us. And there's so much music. We thought about even releasing a soundtrack because there was so much music in Black Luck that people enjoyed. So, you know, but I think for me, I love the aspect of it. I think I kind of grew up with that MTV too, where you actually, it wasn't about reality shows. It was actually watching music videos.
And that was David M. Weiss. I don't know if I need the M, but hey, he used the M in the credits for Cap. So I'm using the M now. And I really want to thank David for taking the time to talk to me. David is an excellent person, I tell you. I've gotten to meet him twice in person at two film festivals. And now I've got the housekeeping to do. So first, Discovery Indie Film started as this podcast where we talk to the best filmmakers from the festival circuit. And that led to the Amazon Prime TV series called Discover Indie Film, which is an anthology of all the best short films from the festival circuit. Just go to Amazon Prime Video and search for Discover Indie Film. And if you're into social media, it's at DIFWINS. W-I-N-S. Wins. I don't know if that sounded clear or not. And I did mention in the intro that David has had a film in both Filmvasion LA and the Sherman Oaks Film Festival, both of which I am the head programmer of. So I need to mention those. If you want to learn more about Filmvasion LA, that happens every June. That is filminvasionla.com or at filminvasionla on social media. And the Sherman Oaks Film Festival, where we were proud to show Cap in 2018, takes place every November, and you can learn about it if you go to shermanoaksff.com or on social media, it's at shermanoaksff. Okay, I think that's all I got to say. Thanks for listening.